About once a week I take off on something. Tonight's the night. You read this book, Yen? Japan's New Financial Empire and Its Threat to America by Daniel Bernstein. A creditor nation. I got an intelligent audience that can handle this. Not everybody's audience can. By the way, I didn't too much appreciate the gratuitous insult that was handed to me in Saturday's metro section of the LA Times or local sections, wherever it went. I was doubly disappointed because it was done by a man that I respect above just about anyone else in the religious journalistic field. Russ Chandler. He did an article on that local convening of the NRB, whom I dubbed 3 years ago, Not Real Bright. Remember, every year for the last 3 years, I've sat here while it went on, this year being the only exception, and dubbed them Not Real Bright. And why did I dub them Not Real Bright? Because they had Jimmy Swaggart as their lead speaker. And you remember, I had a maitre d' in the hotel that called every night telling us some of the idiocies that went on behind the scenes. Well, in the write-up this year, among other things, there was a sentence that said, celebrity or high profiling with celebrities were absent this year. Jimmy Swaggart, Jimmy Baker, Oral Roberts, Gene Scott. I have never attended one of those monkey shine affairs, ever. I mean, they used to attend, those other three. I'm not sure about Oral. I think Oral had more sense than to go to. But I do not appreciate, I got enough reasons to be disliked. I do not appreciate being disliked as a member of a class that I'm not a member of. I have never attended a national religious broadcasters meeting. I wouldn't be caught dead. In that bunch. Boy, you know, I occasionally watch some of their members get drunk on my wine, complaining about their associates. I've told them, why don't you get out, like a nice, intelligent person would do. So, you know, a person is not to be indicted for one strikeout. But that was a real strikeout. I've never been there. I haven't been to the Mustang Ranch. I haven't been to that motel in New Orleans. In all three cases, I'm too high class. I sent a message to that writer today. I use the King's English, too. I'll use blanks this time. I used the King's English in the message. I said I'd much rather they'd bleep all the prostitutes in America than keep bleeping the Christian mind. I'm not in that low-class crowd. Even the criminal language distinguishes between a white-collar criminal and a street thug. Why is the world so ignorant in religion it can see no distinctions? And under any other circumstance, it would be considered false, light slander. And I don't appreciate it. You don't like my cigars, you don't like my language, you don't like my lifestyle, criticize it. But be accurate. But don't shame me. Put me in the camp of those television evangelists. And then the guy beating on the drum, the article said, at the banquet, saying, we don't need any more celebrities, was Jerry Falwell. Glad he's finally seeing the light. An asteroid orifice on national TV does not qualify as a celebrity. He's finally seeing the light. Yeah, he pants around outside Nightline like a street dog. In a kennel full of bitches and heat. I'm surprised that even the paper couldn't see the inconsistency between the guy who has tried to be the biggest celebrity of them all, saying we don't need any celebrities. And that not real bright organization is out there honoring Patty Cake Robinson and Poophead Falwell. As if it is news that I didn't attend this year. The only thing I didn't do this year was get on the air and make the remarks that I'm now making rather belatedly. I felt this year they weren't even worthy of comment. Now, that is not the something that I was going to get on tonight. This is. A creditor nation is one whose investments abroad exceed the size of foreign investments in its own economy. I'd love to tell you what I'm thinking right now. There are some other people whose investments abroad exceed certain things. Would you like me to continue tonight or not? Get on the telephone. A creditor nation is one in whose investments abroad exceed the size of foreign investments in its own economy. A debtor nation is one that owes foreigners more than the sum of its own assets abroad. Creditor nations obviously have a lot of leverage over those to whom they lend their money. Debtor nations often become subservient to the interest of their creditors. Japan replaced the United States as the world's leading creditor in 1986. The scope of recent Japanese capital outflows has been likened to the period in the 50s and 60s when the United States bought up much of Western European industry. But Japanese acquisitions over the last few years have actually far outstripped the American expansion of those days. In fact, Japan's net external out of the country assets already surpassed by 20% the American record established over a 37-year period. Every single working day, Japanese individuals and corporations generate over $1 billion worth of savings. This excess cash rushes into domestic bank accounts, stocks, insurance premiums, and real estate speculation, but even these institutions can't hold it all, like water seeking its own level. A large amount of it must flow abroad. In 1981, Japanese traded foreign securities worth a total of $15 billion for the year. In 1986, the figure was $2.6 trillion. Growth by a factor of 175 times in 5 years. A newly popular Japanese saying summarizes the situation. Quote, "It took Britain 100 years and the United States 50 years to become the richest country in the world, but it only took Japan 5. Japan's ascendancy to world leadership on the positive side of the ledger has been mirrored by America's fall into debt. A creditor nation since 1914, the United States became a net debtor for the first time in the 1980s. Its red ink ran quickly past Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina all the way to the position of world's leading debtor. By the year 2000, Japanese net external assets may reach $1 trillion positive. The figure for the United States could be $1 trillion negative. Every American works 1 month out of 12 to pay our foreign debt, that portion of your taxes. Goes to foreign debt. The United States, now before I'm finished tonight, I'm going to bring this real close to home. I'm tired of all this stuff being nothing but shibboleths. And unmeaningful descriptions of things that produce a glassy-eyed stare instead of understanding. To begin to grasp what this historic role reversal between Japan and America means, here's a short review of some of the ways Japan's financial influence is currently manifesting itself in today's world. One, The United States has come to depend on Japanese investors to directly finance as much as 30% of the American government's budget deficit. The major means of financing government debt, thanks to the Federal Reserve Board and the takeover of this country by private banking institutions, and that Jekyll Island scam, the government finances its debt by selling treasury bills, guaranteed by no hard assets, but simply by the good faith and capacity of the American government to pay its bills. The primary instrument are the long bonds, the 30-year bonds. And in shorter term, 30% are bought up by the Japanese. If the Japanese weren't buying it, the interest rates on those bonds would fall when there's no buyer. And if it took money from the flow of this country to buy it, that takes money out of productive activity. So in essence, the Japanese have been financing 30% of our expansion. In return, holding an IOU on the American government, which can only be paid by taxes generated from the American people. Let's keep going. Throughout 1985 to 87, the leading Japanese security firms were almost always among the largest buyers of long-term U.S. Treasury bonds at auction. Several Japanese-owned firms are primary dealers in securities issued by the U.S. government. Without Japanese participation, it is safe to say the Treasury would have an extremely difficult time financing American debt. Two, all 10 of the world's 10 largest banks, ranked by deposits, today are Japanese. Only one American bank, Citicorp, even makes the somewhat more broadly defined list of the world's top 10 bank holding companies. 30 years ago, not a single Japanese bank was counted in the world's top 50. As recently as 1980, only one Japanese bank ranked in the American-led top 10. Now, they're all top 10. The big four Japanese securities companies, Nomura, Daiwa, Nikko, and Yamaichi, are four of the largest security firms in the world today. In terms of market capitalization, Nomura is currently more than 20 times the size of Merrill Lynch, the largest American brokerage house. 20 times larger. Nomura's pre-tax profits in 1987, $4.1 billion, were about the same, that one company, as the profits of the entire U.S. securities industry. If U.S. subsidiaries of Japanese-owned companies, Nissan, Honda, Sony, and the like, were ranked in the Fortune 500, they would already account for 30 of the biggest U.S. industrial corporations. The Japanese-owned sector is growing 400% faster than the rest of the U.S. economy on the strength of direct investments, approaching $10 billion for 1987, an estimated $15 billion for 1988, and it surpassed that. A 250,000 Americans already work for Japanese employers in the United States. Economists expect that number to rise to 1 million in 1990. The total value of all stocks listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange surpassed the total value of all stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange early in 1987. Tokyo's lead has continued to widen since. A single Japanese company, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, NTT, is worth more than IBM, AT&T, General Motors, General Electric, and Exxon combined. Okay. Japanese banks control nearly 10% of the U.S. retail banking assets, up from next to nothing a decade ago. In trend-setting California, 5 of the top 10 banks are now Japanese. Bank of America, the world's most successful retail bank in the 70s, was rescued from impending collapse by a Japanese consortium. When Los Angeles-based Union Bank was put up for sale, two American banks, Chase and Citicorp, expressed interest in buying it but were prevented from doing so by interstate banking regulations. Instead, Union Bank was bought by California First, which is mostly owned by Bank of Tokyo. Japanese investors bought about $18 billion worth of prime U.S. real estate over the last 3 years, including Church of the Open Door, and I'm going to sue them through a corporation that we have. We already noticed the city of the intent because they tore it down without doing what the city attorney promised. A current environmental impact report. They tear down the last historic church, city of Los Angeles. David versus Goliath. In Hawaii, Japanese investors own more than 75% of the equity in the 20 hotels along the Waikiki beachfront. Just a small part of their $6.5 billion Hawaiian real estate portfolio. Forbes magazine recently observed, quote, although the U.S. flag still flies there, Hawaii looks to be well on the way to becoming an economic colony of Japan. Sony recently acquired CBS Records. Japanese collectors have been the principal force moving the international art market up to where even U.S. museums cannot afford to compete. You say, so what? Shut them out? Too late for that. Well, what's the threat? Well, we're going to see. If you want me to continue, you get on telephone. In fairness, I think I should say that the writer of the article I commented on earlier was very gracious when one of my staff members called, said he did not know that I had not been attending the NRB, which I guess proves he hasn't been listening to me during those times, and that the only point he was trying to make is that high-profile religious people, of whom he considered me one, were not present. And I think he was honest in his response and very decent. But I don't know how many times I have to say to the world, don't put me in the camp of those television evangelists. I never go to places where they gather for fear I'll get spiritual AIDS. One of the jokes, I'm reading from Yin. Price of the book's $19.95. We never sell anything from the church. Dolores Press, a tax-paying, profit-making corporation, which owns this network, markets any book. So if you want to get a copy of the book, we'll see if we can supply some in the bookstore on Sunday, or you can order it and send your check made out for $19.95. We'll assume the shipping, add 6% tax if you're in California. Yen, Japan's New Financial Empire and Its Threat to America, by Daniel Bernstein. One of the most disturbing jokes making the rounds of Tokyo bars recently goes like this. Question, how will Japan win the next war? Answer, we'll get together with the Germans again, but this time we'll leave the Italians out of it. Mm-hmm. By this joke and thousands of other ways, small and large, Tokyo's talk of the town in 1986 in growing sense has ever more focused on the speed that the sun was setting on the American Empire and rising on Japan. I just read the figures of their dominance, the 10 largest banks in America, buying about 30% of the treasury bills that finance America's debt, rapidly, if not already, becoming the wealthiest nation in the world, and creditor nations have always dominated, and debtor nations have always been dominated in history. In the 19th century, it was Great Britain that dominated the world, and London was the financial center of the world. In the 20th century, it's been the United States. Unless some drastic changes occur, in the 21st century, all the characteristics nominate Japan. Basking in the sun of wealth and success, Japanese supremacist ideas experienced their first real renaissance since the war. The perennially popular genre of literature known as Nihonjinron, books that attempt to explain why the Japanese are such a unique people, to colon here, took a more pronounced turn toward answering the question not just of why the Japanese are different, but why they are superior. A typical bestseller was, quote, the Japanese brain. This work purported to demonstrate that, quote, Japanese brains develop differently from those of other races. As one Japan watcher put it, quote, the basic message non-Japanese now seem to be hearing from Japan is, the reason we are number one is that we Japanese are biologically and culturally unique in ways no one else can ever emulate. In the Diet, a faction of 18 members of the ruling Liberal Party, Liberal Democratic Party, demanded that the government stop groveling in front of foreign powers. By this, they meant Japan should stop trying to accommodate American interests on trade matters and cease responding to political pressure from other Asian countries to keep new textbooks out of Japanese schools. The textbooks contained a whitewashed version of World War II and Japan's role in it. Defending them, Education Minister Masayuki Fujio insisted Japan had done, quote, nothing to be ashamed of. He reiterated the old logic of the Imperial Army that Japan had committed no atrocities in China and that Korea was responsible for its own occupation because it invited Japan to annex it. Quote, the core of our education, this is our education minister talking, the core of our education should be to make our children Japanese again, said Fujio, articulating an idea with immense populist appeal. Ultimately, Fujio was forced out of the cabinet over his remarks, but the fact that an important government official had at last said out loud what many people thought was more significant than his political demise. Inexplicably and almost from nowhere, a wave of anti-Semitism swept through the country. Masami Uno's bestseller argued that Japan was victimized by an international Jewish conspiracy. Former Diet member Isaburo Saito penned, quote, the secret of Jewish power to control the world. Between them, the two books sold almost 2 million copies. In 1986 to 87, nearly 100 titles about Jews flooded Japanese bookstores. Some argued that American Jews, alleged to control the U.S. business world, were conspiring to drive the yen up, causing unemployment in Japan. Swastikas appeared in the Ginza with messages accusing Jewish multinational companies of being behind rising land costs in Tokyo. When American reporters picked up on this perplexing trend, Some Japanese even saw a Jewish conspiracy behind the coverage of Japan's talk of a Jewish conspiracy. At a New York Times dinner for foreign journalists after the paper reported on the trend, a Japanese correspondent demanded to know, quote, how many Jewish editors are employed at the New York Times and why the paper covered so many Jewish stories. Of all the troubling words emanating from Japan that season, the most important came from Prime Minister Nakasone himself. Important because Nakasone was not an obscure fanatic or peripheral intellectual, but the strongest, most effective Japanese leader of modern times. He was billed as America's good friend. He had so much in common with Ronald Reagan that their dialogue was dubbed the Ron Yasu Connection. He was seen as the West's best hope for convincing Japan to open its markets and render its society more pluralistic. Now, maybe you noticed what the news people considered to be very funny. Bush tap dancing around to find the right marks on the sidewalk where he's supposed to stand. The Japanese leader was to stand on the right hand, always the symbol of power. Well, you don't expect news people to understand that. But there was another side to Nakasone, which he revealed in a single sentence heard round the world in September of 1986. Just before he was due to take his vision of Japan's new role to the rostrums of the United States, or United Nations, and the U.S. Congress, in a talk to LDP members, that's the Liberal Democratic Party, Nakasone made the declaration. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, sir.
You get on a telephone and get our budget out of the way. No yen accepted tonight. On the telephone. I'm reading from Yen. Japan's New Financial Empire and Its Threat to America by Daniel Bernstein. Not only are we rapidly selling America to the Japanese, and they are becoming the creditor nation and we the debtor, but there are certain signals of attitude associated with this power. Of all the troubling words emanating from Japan that season, the late 80s, which we are in the process of seeing end, the most important came from Prime Minister Nakasone himself. Important because Nakasone was not an obscure fanatic or peripheral intellectual, but the strongest, most effective Japanese leader of modern times. He was billed as America's good friend. But there was another side to Nakasone which he revealed in a single sentence heard round the world in September 1986, just before he was due to take his vision of Japan's new role to the rostrums of the United Nations and the U.S. Congress. In a talk to the Liberal Democratic Party, the ruling party of Japan, Nakasone made the declaration that he believed, quote, America's intellectual level was lower than Japan's because American society had too many blacks, Mexicans, and Puerto Ricans. Would you like to hear that again? Or is that enough? You reckon anybody didn't hear it? Now, end your conversation with whomever is on the phone. Teaching night. Nakasone made the declaration that he believed America's intellectual level was lower than Japan's because American society had too many blacks, Mexicans, and Puerto Ricans. The comment was a reflection of the widely shared Japanese view that dark-skinned peoples, whether in America, Africa, or elsewhere in the Third World, simply are inferior. I'm just reading it, friends. Nakasone's remark ignited a howl of protest in the United States, but most Japanese found nothing to disagree with in it. When 35 members of the Congressional Black and Hispanic Caucuses of Congress demanded an apology, Nakasone agreed to give them one. But like other instances when Japan has bowed to American pressure, the remedy was worse than the original problem. In apologizing, Nakasone offered not sorrow, but pity. He said he would explain all, and he did. What he really meant, he said, was that Japan succeeds where America fails because Japan is a, quote, monoracial society, whereas the United States is weighed down with the presence of multiple nationalities. He wasn't denigrating black and Hispanic Americans, he argued. He was merely taking note of the fact that racially pure Japanese society functions more efficiently than racially mixed America. Americans who paused to reflect on the incident felt a shudder run down their spines. There was more to Nakasone's comments than garden variety racism. There were echoes of master racism, echoes that reach back to the rising sun and the master race who bombed Pearl Harbor. The more he apologized, the more his line of reasoning sounded uncomfortably like the rhetoric of World War II. The timing of Nakasone's endorsement of a monoracial society was significant. The United States and Japan were locked in heated rhetoric of trade war. Japan had just become the world's leading creditor, and Nakasone had just finished hosting the Tokyo Economic Summit. He had repeatedly pledged to the heads of the other industrial democracies that his country would henceforth share the burdens of world leadership. Was this a foreshadowing of the type of, quote, leadership he had in mind? Nakasone's comment was anything but an accidental slip of the tongue. What he said was what he really believed. And although Americans reacted first to its racist content, few could deny a maddening kernel of truth to it. The Japanese educational system does function better than the American system in many respects. Adult illiteracy in the United States is estimated at 8%, while in Japan the figure is the world's lowest, only 1%. About 70% of Americans finish high school versus 95% of Japanese. American high school seniors score 12th in the world in math ability, while Japanese score 2nd. Over the last generation, Japan's mean or average IQ score rose to 111 compared with the U.S. norm of 100. As the world heads deeper into the information age and the U.S.-Japan competition begins to focus on brain-intensive industries, Japan, with 7% higher literacy, 25% better high school completion rates, demonstrably better math skills, and 11 more IQ points, is going to turn its educational advantage to economic benefit. Nakasone wrongly attributed this situation to an ethnic imperative. He was right, however, in the notion that the homogeneity of his society makes the Japanese educational system more workable than the American system, which is trying to cope with an explosion of conflicting demands brought on by the world's most heterogeneous society. In the same speech, Nakasone spoke in even more provocative, if less noticed, terms about the need to save the world by propagating Japan's superior philosophy abroad. Shades of Cecil Rhodes. The whole speech, taken in context, was seen to some observers as representing, or rather as representative of, a mushrooming revival in Japan of Yamatoism, the doctrine of the purity of the Japanese soul derived from the Yamato clan, which unified Japan 1,500 years ago. During World War II, Yamatoism functioned as a Japanese equivalent of Hitler's Aryan supremacy. It provided well-developed justifications for spreading the Japanese Empire across Asia. In his book, War Without Mercy, John Dower documents the rapidity and rabidity with which racism spread on both sides of the Pacific as the United States and Japan were thrust into war. Yamatoism, as depicted by Dower, was no less virulent in racist doctrine than Hitlerism, although considerably more sophisticated. Quote, to view those who are in essence unequal as if they were equal is in itself inequitable, declared the wartime Japanese report cited by Dower. Global policy with the Yamato race as nucleus. Achoo! Now you know it's live. The report reasoned, quote, to treat those who are unequally is to realize equality. Outlining the strategy for Japan's triumph in the Pacific, the report made it clear that the Japanese were, quote, to assume the dominant financial and economic roles formerly played by the European and American colonial powers. The war would continue, quote, until Anglo-American imperialistic democracy had been completely vanquished and a new world order erected in its place. After the war's end, 12 million Japanese would be dispatched to other parts of Asia to oversee the development of the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. 40 years later, it was more than coincidence to find Nakasone. And I'll finish this when we go in the next half hour. Go on telephone. Stephenville, Texas. I just tuned in to Dr. Scott a few minutes ago, and I think he's a very intelligent man. I don't know how you found out it was me. I mean, my people think everybody in the world knows me, and they never even put my name up. I mean, I tell them that occasionally people tune in, want to know who this is. Not everybody watches me every night. But after they watch me for a day or two, they assume that that was only true 2 days ago. This is a very intelligent man who figured out who he's watching. What does he think is going to happen to our silver and gold? I don't think we have enough to back our currency. We haven't had for a long time. Long, long time. Charles de Gaulle got the last big grab on it. We didn't give anybody else a chance. The Japanese are rapidly buying the country. But it's their attitude with that power that's causing some concern. I'm reading from Yen by Daniel Bernstein, 1995. But don't try to buy it from the church. Buy it from Dolores Press. Make your checks out to Dolores Press. You can send it to my address. Put it up. $19.95, we'll ship it to you free, but add tax if you're in California. That clear? No CODs. Send the money and we send the book. Or else go to a bookstore and buy it. You can probably buy it cheaper if you look around, but if you wait till noon tomorrow, you won't. It'll all be gone. Hopefully we'll have some in our bookstore on Sunday. Nakasone made some scary remarks. And it was more than coincidence to find that Nakasone, the recently replaced Prime Minister of Japan, funded a national Japanology institute whose mission was to delve into issues defining the uniqueness of the Japanese race. During his tenure, Nakasone often argued for a, quote, post-war settlement of accounts, by which he meant Japan should close the era of self-deprecation and develop a strong national identity again. For inspiration as to the content of Japan's new identity, Nakasone conversed regularly with a group of ultranationalist scholars known as the Kyoto School. Among their circle, some preached an overt brand of Yamato supremacy and called for a drive to purify Japanese culture by ridding it of Western influences. The significance of Nakasone's colloquy with the Kyoto School, noted Japan expert Ian Buruma, was comparable to the West German Chancellor deciding to hold an ongoing dialogue with a circle of Munich intellectuals inspired by the ideas of Nazi theoreticians. Nakasone became the first post-war Japanese Prime Minister to accede to right-wing pressure to visit the Yasukuni Shrine, an emotionally charged memorial to those who died for the empire, including many so-called Class A war criminals responsible for Japanese atrocities. Most leading politicians, including today's Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita, have since made their own visits. But now, to what this financial power the Japanese have can do. The first time Wall Street glimpsed the power Japanese investors had gained in the American financial marketplace was in 1986. And the quake was half over before most of the financial community even realized what was happening. It began toward the end of April. Up and down Wall Street, high-salaried bond traders watched their computer terminals in stunned disbelief. Somebody was doing something weird to the biggest, most liquid, and best guaranteed financial market in the world, the bonds that represent the debt of the United States government, which we must pay through taxes. Bond departments at Wall Street's major firms had a lot to lose. Traders were riding the crest of a discovery that they could play the arbitrage game just like their colleagues on the stock side. And one of their standard arbitrage gambits involved the quarterly auctions of U.S. Treasury bonds, particularly the benchmark 30-year variety known as the long bond. Over the years, long bonds have been extremely attractive investment vehicles for cash-rich institutions like pension funds and insurance companies. Even with America's massive debts, the financial world still believes that there's no better guarantee than the one offered by the historic stability of the U.S. government. Presumably, even in a cataclysmic panic, Washington would continue to honor obligations to holders of its own debt. At least that's what the vast majority of global investors have believed up until now, based on Washington's unblemished record of debt repayment through the twists and turns of 20th century economic history. Treasury bond interest rates are also considered the world's most competitively determined. This is because they are sold in a full auction system with dealers bidding on how many bonds they will buy at what interest rates. Because U.S. government debt is so large but its credit is so good, the market is huge, global, and constant. The owner of a long bond can sell to a buyer in the secondary market often in a matter of minutes, and usually without precipitating a major price movement. The long bond's unique characteristics make it one of the most widely watched barometers of interest rates. Its movements are reflected in trading patterns for the shorter-term bills and bonds issued by the government. Together, these instruments directly influence the prime rate, mortgage, and car loan rates. Certificates of deposit yields and the other financial reference points that ultimately have a powerful impact on the daily lives of most people. Since the end of 1984, the most enthusiastic buyers of these bonds have been Japanese. As Japan's trade surplus climbed to staggering figures, Japanese banks, insurance companies, and industrial corporations had little time to rationally plan how best to invest the proceeds. Like a scene from The Sorcerer's Apprentice, they raced to find foreign markets large enough to absorb the extraordinary overflow of dollars piling up in Japan. Our philosophy toward treasury bonds during those days was very simple, recalls Masahiro Dozen, chief of the bond department of the Tokyo headquarters of Daiwa Securities. He said it could be summed up as buy, 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 and buy they did. The big four Japanese security firms, Nomura, Daiwa, Nikko, Yamaichi, routinely bought a third to a half of all new U.S. long bonds during this period. Too hot. At one 1986 auction, Japanese investors bought 80% of the issue. In business terms, Japan had become the lead banker to the Reagan administration and chief financier of the exploding U.S. budget deficit. To put it in street language, Washington had grown addicted to foreign capital. America had become a desperate junkie, and Japan was its pusher. The White House seemed perfectly comfortable with the situation. Ready availability of Japanese buyers for U.S. bonds enabled interest rates to continue falling during 1985 and 86. Lower interest rates, in turn, allowed millions of Americans to release pent-up home-buying desires and permitted business and industry a chance to expand without the double-digit borrowing costs that had paralyzed the economy in the prior decade. Falling interest rates also fueled what was then a rampaging bull market on Wall Street as investors abandoned conservative money market funds and CDs in favor of the ecstatic New York Stock Exchange ticker. Now, if the foreigners weren't buying it, they'd have to make the bills more attractive. To raise the bills more attractive, or to make them more attractive, to get money out of stocks and other kinds of investments and CDs, they'd have to raise the interest. And as the interest shoots up, you know what happens to home buying opportunities and car buying opportunities? Too hot in here. It has been the Japanese readiness to buy all of the government debt financing that has kept the interest rate of the bonds down, which has kept other interest rates down, which has fueled the rampaging bull market we've seen. Japan's willingness to lend its trade surplus back to the United States rather than investing it at home or in other countries was a critical ingredient, allowing the expansion of military spending, expanding the budget deficit, and stimulating the economy, all the while slicing taxes. The sleight of hand most Americans failed to notice was that once every 3 months, while all this was going on, when the Treasury had to be refunded, it was foreigners who were paying the bill. If Japanese investors hadn't bought $90 billion worth of U.S. government debt in 1986, the U.S. budget deficit would have intruded painfully on American life and forms raging, ranging from sharply higher mortgage rates to higher taxes and deeper, more socially divisive cuts in government programs. At the beginning, bond traders found nothing particularly disturbing about a treasury market driven by Japanese investors. They merely followed their instincts and adjusted their sights in the direction of Tokyo. Every morning, the question is, what are the Japanese doing? A top specialist observed of life in First Boston's bond department. Every morning, what are the Japanese doing? A lot of money could be made by knowing the answer to that question. One thing traders noticed the Japanese doing was selling off previously acquired long bonds just before a new treasury auction in order to buy a new bond. The theory behind this pattern was that being long-term planners, the Japanese wanted their portfolios invested as far into the future as possible, even just 3 months further. Thus, as the May 1986 treasury auction approached, Wall Street bond dealers fully expected Japanese investors to continue the pattern they had established, selling off chunks of their holdings in long bonds maturing in February of that year, 2016, 30 years later, to replace them with the newly available bonds maturing 3 months later, May 2016. Bond arbs, or arbitrage specialists, had learned how to play this pattern. In April, they began a reprise of what most believed would be self-evident profit. They shorted, or sold short, the February 2016 bond, meaning they sold bonds they didn't yet own. They expected that by the time they needed to actually deliver the bonds they sold, they'd have no problem obtaining them fractionally cheaper from Japanese investors eager to sell before buying the new issue. Even though the price differential between selling a bond short today and buying it back next week might be only a few hundredths of a percent, those decimal places are life and death in the trading room. Dealers who handle volumes in the billions on a daily basis know how to get very rich very quick on seemingly infinitesimal percentages. This time, though, their strategy went haywire. Instead of falling, the price of the old bonds began rising. Traders went into a frenzied scramble trying to buy back the bonds they'd shorted. This motion drove prices up still further. When bids are met, the word hit flashes on the trader's computer screen, just as in a video game, but nothing was hitting. The big squeeze was on, and much of Wall Street was caught in the vice. Somewhere, the February 2016 U.S. Treasury bond was being hoarded. Somewhere, owners of that bond were refusing to sell it even for a substantial premium over its technical market value. That somewhere, Wall Street eventually figured out, was Tokyo. The Japanese, whom most bond traders had taken for being conservative, predictable, and inexperienced in U.S. financial markets, were enacting what appeared to be a brilliant, daring strategy no American professional had foreseen. The Japanese did to us on the long bond what they did to us at Pearl Harbor, fumed a top trader. Another compared the wild price distortion to the Hunt brothers' attempt to corner the world silver market. The bloodletting got worse as the days wore on. Aggregate losses on Wall Street reached $350 million. Senior traders making high six-figure salaries found their jobs suddenly on the line as management committees began to realize the extent of the damage. Get a hold of those bonds somewhere, the word went out. Do it now or you're finished. But for all their street smarts, nothing the New York dealers tried could break the back of the squeeze. Oh, all this financial stuff makes me glassy-eyed. I'm not interested in you continuing. Is that what you're saying? When salvation finally came, it came from Tokyo, like a white knight on horseback. No Mura Security stepped in from Japan to make $500 million worth of the hoarded American bonds available to American dealers. Once those bonds started flowing through the system, the costly crisis receded. When it was all over, and Wall Street had finished emptying its pockets, there was still confusion about what had happened and why. If it had been an orchestrated attempt to corner the market a la the Hunt brothers, why had Nomura stepped in so gallantly just when the squeeze was working best? If cornering the market wasn't their intention, just what were the Japanese trying to prove? One theory held that the Japanese, Nomura in particular, had conspired to hoard the bonds in order to teach their American counterparts a lesson. If they did, that is, that was their intent, they succeeded. Another line of reasoning viewed the squeeze as a power play carried out by some or all of the big four Japanese houses, then applying to enter the exclusive club of primary dealers. A group of approximately 40 securities firms accorded the right to do business directly with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Primary dealership increases bond trading profits modestly by cutting down on middlemen. It also carries a great deal of prestige. Ever since a wave of scandal-laden bankruptcy shook the bond business in the early 1980s, many blue-chip buyers insist on trading exclusively through primary dealers. Japanese firms, steeped in the cultural desire for honor and enmeshed in the implementation of a business strategy aimed at acceptance in the American marketplace, wanted very badly to become primary dealers. The volume of their business justified elevation to such status, but rival American securities firms, afraid of losing market share, wanted the Japanese blackballed. More visceral was the opposition of politicians, who believed the bargaining chip of primary dealership should not be given away until Tokyo agreed to open its financial markets to wider American participation. Thus, the bond squeeze may have been mounted by Japanese houses, intent on demonstrating they were too powerful to be denied their rightful place. If true, the tactic worked well. 6 months later, the Federal Reserve Bank welcomed the two biggest Japanese firms, Nomura and Daiwa, as primary dealers. Yet the full explanation of the squeeze may rely on a phenomenon at once more prosaic and more profound. Americans do not understand the Japanese financial system. According to sources at Nomura, the cause of the uproar was at the very least, they demonstrated it's too late to try to push them around. If you ever get very forward pushing the bank around that holds the loan on your house and your car, for the hospital you owe for the birth of your kid, does the Bible have anything to say about this? Yeah. But I'm concerned right now to know if you're going to be in the King's House Sunday, so get on the telephone.